Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dave Johnson of the Campaign for America's Future, who assesses the debt ceiling deal approved by Congress and signed by President Obama, observing that the agreement was a total victory for right-wing extremists. Bruce Nillis, Deputy Conservation Director of the Sierra Club, who talks about how his group will use a recent $50 million gift from New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg in their Beyond Coal campaign. And Chip Berlay of Political Research Associates, who examines the anti-Muslim motivation of Norwegian mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik, whose shooting rampage and bombing killed 77 people on July 22nd. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Jobless rates for black men have hit Depression-era levels in cities like Detroit, Las Vegas, Milwaukee, and Minneapolis-St. Paul. Nationally, the unemployment rate among black men has hit 17%, more than double the rate for adult white males. African American men face several barriers to the job market, including a disproportionately large percentage having criminal records and lower educational levels. At the same time, city governments, which have traditionally hired large numbers of African American males, are slashing jobs. In growing sectors like finance and information technology, blacks face stiff barriers to being hired, such as the lack of advanced college degrees. Labor Secretary Hilda Solis says her agency has tripled the number of investigations related to race-based job discrimination in the hiring and firing of black workers. Missouri Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, told the Christian Science Monitor, "The failure of this nation to address this problem will lead to another 25 years of problems in this country based on race." He says, "We ignore this crisis at our own nation's peril." In the aftermath of the January 2010 massive earthquake in Haiti, the Clinton Foundation promised to build new hurricane-proof shelters in the coastal city of Léogène, which is vulnerable to tropical storms. The project, which was highly promoted by the foundation, has run into trouble. According to an investigation by The Nation magazine, the shelters were built as prefabricated trailers and were constructed by the same company, Clayton Homes, that delivered formaldehyde-laced trailers to victims of Hurricane Katrina in Greater New Orleans. The trailers in Haiti that have been used as school classrooms have accumulated mold and become dangerously hot as temperatures rise in the tropical heat. Levels of formaldehyde were found to be 2.5 times the safe level set by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control for sensitive persons, including children. Haiti's hurricane season started on June 1st, with storm experts predicting that 18 tropical storms could hit the island nation this year. Throughout its website, the Clinton Foundation promotes the prefab trailers as hurricane-proof. Larry Tanner, a wind science expert at Texas Tech University, called the claim suspicious because Clayton Homes never conducted actual wind tests on the trailers. Tanner insists the trailers do not meet international construction standards for emergency shelters. The Miami Herald reports U.S. travel tour companies are lining up to offer people-to-people cultural excursions to Cuba. So far, the U.S. Treasury Department, which regulates travel by Americans to Cuba under the embargo dating to the early 1960s, has issued 30 licenses for purposeful travel to Cuba. Such people-to-people tours were halted in 2003 by an order from the George W. Bush administration. Insight Cuba, which ran tours to Cuba before the 2003 ban, will begin people-to-people tours in August. Other tour operators, including Harvard University Alumni Association and high-end tour company Abercrombie & Kent, plan cultural tours of Cuba in the fall. The Insight Cuba Tour includes an 8-day excursion focusing on Cuban arts, including meeting Afro-Cuban artists, and a visit to EGRIM, Cuba's largest recording label. Miami's Cuban-American political establishment is fiercely opposed to allowing more U.S. tourists to visit Cuba. South Florida Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart and David Rivera are pushing a bill to ban the new people-to-people Cuban tours. The bill would also limit visits by family members to Cuba to once every 3 years. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
In an unprecedented political act, congressional Republicans, driven by their right-wing Tea Party members, successfully used the nation's need to raise the debt ceiling to extort historic cuts in the federal budget. The deal, passed by the House and Senate and signed by President Obama on the deadline date of August 2nd, would raise the debt ceiling by $2.1 trillion in two steps and cuts $2.5 trillion from the budget over the next 10 years. The agreement features an initial spending cut of $1 trillion, followed by the formation of a 12-member bipartisan supercommittee that will be charged with recommending another $1.5 trillion in cuts by Thanksgiving that could include changes to Medicare and Social Security and tax increases. If Congress fails to adopt the committee's recommendations by December 23rd, the legislation will automatically reduce spending beginning in 2013, with half taken from both domestic and defense spending. Social Security, Medicaid, military, and civilian pensions, and most low-income programs would be exempt. Medicare cuts would be limited to payments to medical providers. Many progressive members of Congress voted against the debt ceiling deal, characterizing the 11th-hour agreement as a sellout of working families to Tea Party extremists engaging in political blackmail. Representative Emanuel Cleaver of Missouri, a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, labeled the deal as a sugar-coated Satan sandwich. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dave Johnson, a fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. He warns that the agreement was a total victory for right-wing extremists that rewards the rich and punishes the nation's poor and working families.
Well, we have signed on to almost entirely a conservative right-wing agenda here of cutting and cutting, preserving the tax cuts for the wealthy, and this was done with a gun to the country's head. They literally, and people got pretty sure they would do it, were going to force the country to default if we didn't give them what they want. It's astonishing to think about it, but it's actually only part of a series of these that we've now seen. Well, you remember the bailout, the huge bailout, where we saw the beginning of the pattern, where we're presented with this horrible crisis, the Congress has to act immediately to save the country, and the terms of it are that essentially, we had to hand over a huge amount of money to bail out Wall Street and preserve their fortunes. And literally, we only had hours at the time that we had to do this before significant opposition could be rallied, before people had time to wake up and focus and get details and see if this was really the case and look at alternative ideas. Then we saw 2 years of obstruction of democracy, of almost every single thing that the Congress tried to do was then filibustered in the Senate. Even when we had that, what's called a supermajority in the Senate, where there were enough Democrats elected to break these filibusters, we had Joe Lieberman break ranks and sometimes other members. Then we saw the tax extensions, where once again, they held a hostage. They said, we're not going to give anything to the unemployed if you don't renew these tax cuts for the wealthy. But then there was the government shutdown once again. And it all went to the very last minute so that to avert a government shutdown, the vote had to happen immediately because the negotiators took so long and were handed an announcement from on high somewhere so we, the people, don't get a chance to interfere. And we averted the government shutdown with a huge number of cuts in the things that our government does for us, that we, the people, our government, do for each other. And then this was the big kahuna of hostage taking, and I don't really need to relate a lot of what happened here, I guess.
Dave, In the second phase of this this process of raising the debt ceiling, there is the appointment of a bipartisan super committee that's supposed to arrive at lots more cuts. And Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, as well as the Pentagon budget, are all going to be on the table. There's a sort of Damocles hanging over the committee's head that if they don't come to an agreement somewhere near Thanksgiving, that automatic cuts that both the Democrats and Republicans dislike will go into effect. What can be done between now and Thanksgiving to rev up a progressive base who aren't very happy with this agreement as it stands now and are very worried about entitlement programs and cuts that very well could be made to them, especially given some of the statements of support for that very thing by President Obama? What can be done in this next few months?
First of all, if you're someone who cares about democracy, this whole process that has happened, and especially this idea that there's going to be this super Congress that then comes and tells us how it's going to be, it's kind of offensive, I think. But people are saying, look, we can at least try to get some really strong progressives on there to make sure that it doesn't just hear the same old centrist, as called, you know, you call it, well, we have to cut Medicare and Social Security, kind of a voice on this. So one thing you can do is you can call your members of Congress, your senators, and say, we want strong progressives put on this 12-member commission. Unfortunately, the commission will deadlock because you know that all six Republicans will refuse any kind of tax increases. Here we are again. We're in this bind. They lock it in before we can react and organize the forces of democracy to do something about this.
Dave Johnson, to close off here, it's clear by now to most of the country, and the polling data bears this out, that most people perceive the Republican agenda, and especially the Tea Party agenda, is to protect the wealthiest sector of the country at all costs, and including political blackmail to get their way, and that major threats are now posed against some of the most popular government programs over the decades, and that's Social Security and Medicare. And it seems that nothing short of a grassroots mobilization or rebellion is going to shake some sense into the White House and Congress to reject this kind of austerity, which has always led to the working families and the poor of this country to take the brunt, while the wealthy and the Republican supporters in Congress are laughing on the yachts drinking cocktails.
I would say one good thing I see is that more and more people are seeing this and understanding it. The problem is that there's no organized pressure sufficient on the Democrats that is doing as the old famous FDR statement where he said, I agree with you, I want to do it, now make me do it. We don't have that organizational structure in place to make them do it. And in a democracy, a politician has to respond to what they see out there is what the public wants. We're not currently well enough expressing that this is what the public wants and enforcing that, because we need to then be able to primary people who aren't with us. We need this grassroots movement you talked about. This was such a naked aggression against democracy, I think, that people are saying, hold on here, you know, do we really want a system that works like this? I am hopeful that we're actually going to see a good reaction, but unfortunately right now we're going to have to deal with a slower economy and the results of this hostage-taking we went through.
That was Dave Johnson, a fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. Read more critical analysis on the debt ceiling agreement at our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On July 21st, Bloomberg Philanthropies, funded by New York City Mayor and billionaire Michael Bloomberg, announced a gift of $50 million made to the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, an effort which has successfully blocked the building of 153 proposed coal-fired power plants in the U.S. since 2002. With Bloomberg's gift, the Sierra Club will be able to double their staff to almost 200 employees and expand their campaign from 14 to 45 states, including the District of Columbia. The environmental group's next phase in their campaign will focus on shutting down existing coal plants while proposing cleaner alternatives. The main thrust of the Sierra Club's drive is to reduce the impacts on climate change from burning coal, which produces large amounts of carbon dioxide. The campaign will also focus on public education, on how coal is destroying the communities where it's mined, as well as the health hazards to those living downwind of operating coal plants. Coal currently provides 45% of the electricity used in the U.S. and produces more than a third of the greenhouse gases. Like many environmental groups, the Sierra Club is targeting their grassroots organizing on local state campaigns, given the fact that the GOP-controlled House of Representatives is staunchly opposed to federal legislation limiting greenhouse gases. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bruce Nillis, Deputy Conservation Director of the Sierra Club, who talks about how the campaign will put Bloomberg's gift to work.
The work really began in 2002, 2003, responding to a rush to build a bunch of new coal-fired power plants. That work is largely over, and we've stopped to date 153 proposed, i.e. new, coal plants. Only one proposed coal plant has broken ground since November of 2008, and we're basically down to a handful of states where there's any new projects proposed. Beginning 2010, we had been shifting our efforts to retiring existing coal plants. There's about 520 existing coal plants. And really digging into and supporting at the community level folks who have been suffering from the consequences of these old coal plants, whether it's air pollution, whether it's families in Kentucky who are getting coal ash blowing all over their houses and their kids having acute asthma problems, and helping community by community, plant by plant, retire and replace those coal plants with clean energy. So with Bloomberg Philanthropy's major gift, we will be able to expand this work from Washington to Florida and California to Maine. We get regular requests from local community members who are suffering from their neighboring coal plant or their neighboring coal ash pond or nearby coal mining projects. This gift allows us to support them, to help empower them and elevate and demand something be done to address the problems that they're facing from coal. And that obviously allows us to have the discussion about it's time to get these coal plants retired. And we have a very aggressive goal of, over the next 10 years, retiring one-third of the coal fleet.
When you say replace them with clean energy, what does that mean? Is part of your project to get clean energy sources actually up and running?
Exactly. And it's in large part a recognition that these coal plants are not going to be able to retire unless we actually have enough electricity coming from alternate sources. And so that requires us to make sure and be advocating for and secure investments, major investments, in clean energy. And what we would like to see is that the bulk of it is wind and solar with some geothermal and large amounts of energy efficiency.
You didn't mention natural gas. Does that mean that's not part of the mix that you're promoting?
We are cognizant that natural gas needs to be at least for the next 10 or 20 years. While we're scaling up renewables, will be part of the picture. Our goal is to minimize natural gas as much as possible.
What about gas from horizontal hydraulic fracturing or fracking, which is more problematic than the old vertical gas wells?
That's exactly why we want to see as little natural gas as possible.
Bruce Nillis, can you say more about how your campaign actually promotes clean energy?
Well, they're actually two sides of the same coin, because the regulators who are charged with ensuring reliability of our electricity grid are not going to allow coal plants to come offline unless we have something else producing electricity. And so there are a variety of venues and ways to secure large amounts of clean energy. As you probably know, there's been a lot of work in the past with dozens of states that have renewable energy standards, which mandate clean energy get to scale. So you have states like California with a 33% requirement, Colorado 30%, Minnesota 25%, aggressive standards up and down the East Coast. So pushing and getting in place policies requiring a certain percentage come from clean energy is one way. The other is, as we are engaged in the various regulatory proceedings around retiring a coal plant, there is the opportunity to both engage with the regulators and the owner of an old coal plant to talk about what the alternatives could be and to shape what those alternatives will be, so they don't turn around and propose a new coal plant, but they, in fact, are proposing something we like. So there's a variety of different venues, whether it's new state policies, it can be at the city level. I don't know if you saw San Antonio just announced it was shutting down its coal plant and building 400 megawatts of solar. That was a part of advocacy by our local activists.
They could do it. San Antonio has a lot of sun, and Texas also has a lot of wind.
Texas has a lot of wind. Every state in the union except for Alaska has huge solar potential. Germany last year installed 9,000 megawatts, which is nine times more than the U.S. installed last year. Germany has less solar potential than any state in the union except for Alaska. So this is not because the technology doesn't work in even our most northern states, again, Alaska excepted. And so if you look at where we're seeing solar development, obvious place, California, but you're also seeing significant development in New Jersey and beginning to see some progress in New York. And why New Jersey, New York is because New Jersey has good solar policies. And so getting the right policies in place, we think, is critical. And the other great thing about solar and wind is that the prices continue to come down. At the same time, the cost of coal continues to skyrocket.
That was Bruce Nellis of the Sierra Club. Learn more about the group's Beyond Coal campaign by visiting our website at btlonline.org. Anders Behring Breivik, the confessed perpetrator in last month's bombing of Norway's government buildings in Oslo and a shooting rampage at a Labour Party youth camp that killed 77 people and wounded nearly 100, was motivated by his hatred of Muslim immigrants. In a 1,500-page manifesto published on the Internet just before Breivik launched his terrorist attacks, the mass murder suspect declares that his violent operation of July 22nd was planned for 2 years in order to help halt the Islamization of Norway and Europe. In his manifesto titled 2083, A European Declaration of Independence, the 32-year-old Breivik describes himself as one of several leaders of the national and pan-European patriotic resistance movement. He anticipates a European civil war taking place in three stages, ending in 2083 with the execution of cultural Marxists and the deportation of Muslims. In laying out his views, Breivik extensively quotes many U.S.-based right-wing Christian activists who share his fear and hatred of Muslims and the threat they believe their religion poses to Western culture and democracy. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chip Berlay, senior analyst with Political Research Associates, who examines the motivation of the Norwegian mass murderer and the disturbing links with like-minded American Christian right organizations and individuals.
Well, essentially, he's really not a Christian fundamentalist. He's a moderate Christian by his own description, and he's part of a kind of global movement that sees basically the spread of Islam as threatening Western culture. So basically, if you took Huntington's thesis of the clash of civilization and armed it, you'd get Breivik. And of course, in the United States, these kinds of views are on Fox News. They're in major newspapers. They're in major media. The Islamophobia that's tolerated in the United States is pretty horrifying. And the particular line that Breivik followed is basically a conspiracy theory that cultural Marxism was created by the Frankfurt School ideologues, and that another name for that is political correctness or multiculturalism. And that those are the forces that allow Muslim immigration and the destruction of Judeo-Christian nations in Europe and the destruction of the United States. Now, the irony here is Breivik himself supports Israel and is what's called philo-Semitic. He likes the Jews because they're against the Muslims, in his view, which is not accurate, but again, we're talking about his view. Some do, some don't. But the joke here is that the cultural Marxism thesis that he picked up by William S. Lind, who worked with Paul Weyrich at the Free Congress Foundation, a Christian right think tank in Washington, Lind went on to develop a very anti-Semitic version of this conspiracy theory in which it was the Jewish Marxists at the Frankfurt School who developed this to destroy Christianity and Christian culture. And so you have this strange thing where Breivik is neither Christian Zionist, Christian right fundamentalist, nor is he a neo-Nazi. You might argue his xenophobia is so profound you could call him quasi-fascist, but he really represents the kinds of views that you can see in a lot of conservative right and Christian right publications warning about Islam.
And Chip, what was Breivik's motive for the massive scale of violence he perpetrated with the bombing in downtown Oslo and killing these kids, you know, one by one in the shooting rampage on the island where this political party had its youth camp?
Well, he saw himself as a new crusader. He says that he is part of a new Knights Templar movement, and the Knights Templar were soldiers in the Crusades against Islam and the Holy Land Wars. And so he basically saw himself as leading this new crusade to crush Islam as it was crushed before by Christian crusaders. And in the context of Norway's politics, the Progressive Labor Party, of course, was seen by Breivik and others on the right as promoting multiculturalism, and in fact they did promote tolerance and respect, and promoting basically policies which Breivik and other right-wingers wrongly attributed to their hatred of Christianity and Western culture. And so he set out to blow up the government building in which the Labor Party governed, and then it wasn't just a youth camp, it was a youth training camp for young activists in the Labor Party who were being groomed to go on into party positions in the government and in political life. So he saw himself as ridding Norway of the vermin, spreading cultural Marxism and political correctness, and thus allowing the Muslims to come in and wreck the society.
You have long followed right-wing movements in this nation, and as you've examined Breivik and his writings, you've discovered many links to U.S.-based Islamophobic groups and individuals and Christian right organizations. Tell us about some of the most significant links that you found and really what it means in terms of the rising of anti-Islamic movements in the United States.
There's a lot of people who have been looking at the influences. I tracked the actual writings of William S. Lind of the Free Congress Foundation, both attributed and unattributed in the Breivik manuscript. Others have tracked, especially Max Blumenthal, the massive empire of Islamophobia in the United States and how that has been playing into this promotion. The more you demonize and scapegoat a target group, the more likely it is that someone will see that as a call to violence, and it also allows the plausible deniability of saying, well, I never meant kill them. But, of course, that was Hannah Arendt's basic thesis of understanding how totalitarian movements work, is that the leader says, who will rid me of these alien forces? And the most militant followers know that that's a call to rub them out.
That was Chip Erlay, senior analyst with Political Research Associates. Read more about the links between European and American anti-Islamic movements on our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.